Then victims advocate Robin Finnegan introduced the larger idea. Kids felt as if their identities had been stolen. Columbine was the name of a tragedy now. The school was a symbol of mass murder. They had been cast as bullies or snotty rich brats. There comes a point where victims need to have ownership of their tragedy, Finnegan said. So far, the media owned the Columbine tragedy. That was about to change, the district said. Or good luck getting your precious Columbine Returns stories. Administrators outlined the gist of the ceremony. What's the human chain for? A reporter asked. To shield the students from you folk, district spokesman Rick Kaufman said. Most media would be excluded. A small pool would be escorted in. Reporters were incredulous. One print reporter? The White House didn't limit its pool that tightly. Reporters for the big national papers huddled in the back of the room, discussing options to lawyer up. The district wouldn't back down, Kaufman said. In fact, the pool would come only with major concessions. No helicopters, no rooftop photographers, and no breach of school grounds. If we can't get agreement, then there's no pool, he said. Try it, reporters threatened. It will backfire. As long as parents understand that by saying no to everything, again, it's going to be a situation where we're coming out of rocks and stuff in order to get sound and pictures, a TV executive said. And I wonder if the parents really understand. If they think they control us by just saying no, they're really not. They're forcing us to go in other directions. Kaufman said his back was to the wall. Angry parents had objected to any pool at all. Parents and faculty, they have really hit the wall with you folks. They're saying, we're done. Enough is enough. Later that week, a compromise was reached. The pool was expanded slightly, and a bullpen was added within the shield, where interested students could approach cordoned-off reporters. The press agreed to all previous demands and two new ones. No kid would be approached on the way to school that morning, and no photographs of any of the injured survivors would be used. The kids finally felt a sense of victory. Mr. D was excited about the rally, but he was also worried about the new kids. It was a principal's thing. The incoming freshman always commanded his thoughts this time of year. Kids would either assimilate quickly or spend 4 years struggling to fit in. The first 2 weeks were crucial. Mr. D chose to combat the chasm by highlighting it. He met with the academic and sports teams and the student senate over the summer, and he gave every kid and every teacher the same mission. These kids will never understand you. They will never endure your pain, never bridge the gap between social classes that you did. So help them. By and large, they went for it. Kids thought they were overwhelmed by their own struggle, but what they really needed was someone else to look out for. They had to solve a different sort of pain to comprehend how to heal their own. Mr. D's team brainstormed up a slew of activities to grease the transition. The wall tile project seemed like an easy one. For 3 years, kids had been painting 4-inch ceramic tiles in art class. 500 had been plastered above the lockers to brighten the Columbine corridors. 1,500 new tiles would be added before school resumed, representing the single most noticeable change to the interior. For one morning, kids could express their grief or hope or desires visually and abstractly, without the intervention of words that wouldn't come. Brian Fusile didn't want his parents standing in the human shield. The more you do that, the more you make it unnatural, he told his dad. Brian was doing okay with the trauma. He just wanted his life back and his school back, the way it had been. That's just not going to happen, his father said. Agent Fusile took Monday morning off from the investigation to join the chain. Mimi stood beside him. By 7 a.m., kids were streaming in with their parents. By 7:30, the shield was 500 strong. It would grow much larger. The parents applauded each student's arrival. Most of the kids wore matching white T-shirts emblazoned with their rallying cry, "We Are" on the front, and "Columbine" on the back. Small contingents had opted for their own messages. Yes, I believe in God. Or victors, not victims. Frank DeAngelis took the microphone, and a group of kids screamed, "We love you, Mr. D!" He teared up at the welcome, then delivered a touching speech. "You may be feeling a little anxious," he said, "but you need to know that you are not in this alone." The school's American flags were raised from half-mast for the first time since April 20th, symbolically ending the period of mourning. A ribbon across the entrance was cut, and Patrick Ireland led the student body in. 44. Bombs are hard. Eric was counting on a slow recovery. He was less concerned about killing hundreds of people on April 20th than about tormenting millions for years. His audience was the target. He wanted everyone to agonize, the student body, residents of Jeffco, the American public, the human race. Eric amused himself with the idea of coming back as a ghost to haunt survivors. He would make noises to trigger flashbacks and drive them all insane. Anticipation satiated Eric for months. Then, it was time to act. Senior year, just before Halloween, he began assembling his arsenal. Eric sat down in his room with a stack of fireworks, split each one down the side, and tapped the shiny black powder into a coffee can. Once he had a sufficient volume, he tipped the can and guided a fine little trickle into a carbon dioxide cartridge. He measured it out carefully, almost to the rim. Then he applied a wick, sealed it off, and set it aside. One cricket, ready for detonation. He was pleased with his work. He assembled 9 more. The pipe bombs required a lot more gunpowder, as well as a PVC pipe to house each one. Eric assembled 4 of those that day. The first 3 he designated the Alpha Batch. Not bad, but he could do better. He set them aside and tried a different approach. He built just 1 bomb for the Beta Batch. Better. Still room for improvement. That was enough for one day. Eric drew up a chart to record his production data. He set up columns to log each batch by name, size, quantity, shrapnel content, and power load. Then he rated his work. 6 of his 8 batches would earn an excellent assessment. His worst performance was okay. The next day, Eric got right back to it, producing 6 more pipe bombs, the rest of the Beta Batch. Later, he would create Charlie, Delta, Echo, and Foxtrot, using military lingo for all of the batches, except that soldiers use Bravo, not Beta. Eric penned nearly a dozen new journal entries in the next 2 months. "I have a goal to destroy as much as possible," he wrote. "So I must not be sidetracked by my feelings of sympathy, mercy, or any of that." It was a mark of Eric's ruthlessness that he comprehended the pain and consciously fought the urge to spare it. "I will force myself to believe that everyone is just another monster from doom," he wrote. "I have to turn off my feelings." "Keep one thing in mind," he said. He wanted to burn the world. That would be hard. He had begun producing the explosives, and it was a lot of work. 10 pipe bombs and 10 puny crickets after 2 days' effort. Those would not destroy much. "God, I want to torch and level everything in this whole fucking area," he said. "But bombs of that size are hard to make." Eric took a few moments to enjoy the dream. He envisioned half of Denver on fire, napalm streams eating the skin off skyscrapers, explosive gas tanks ripping through residential garages. Napalm recipes were available online. The ingredients were readily attainable. But he had to be realistic. It would be very tricky getting all of our supplies, explosives, weaponry, ammo, and then hiding it all, and then actually planting it all, he said. A lot could go wrong in the next 6 months, and if they did get busted, we start killing then and there. I ain't going without a fight. Eric repeated that last line, almost verbatim in an English essay. The assignment was to react to a quote from literature, and Eric had chosen this line from Euripides' tragedy, Medea. "No, like some yellow-eyed beast that has killed its hunter, let me lie down on the hounds' bodies and the broken spears." Medea was declaring that she would die fighting, Eric wrote. They would never take her without a struggle. He repeated that sentiment 7 times in a page and a quarter. He described the Medea as brave and courageous, tough and strong, and hard as stone. It is one of the most impassioned public essays Eric left behind. For years after his death, Eric would be seen as a bundle of contradictions. But the threads come together in "I Ain't Going Out Without a Fight." Eric dreamed big, but settled for reality. Unfortunately, that passage remained hidden from the public for years. Scattered quotes from his writings would leak out, and viewed as fragments, they could seem contradictory. Was Eric planning a gun battle, or a plane crash, or a terrorist attack bigger than Oklahoma City's? If he was so intent on mass murder, why did he kill only 13? Trying to understand Eric from the information available was like reading every 5th page of a novel and concluding that none of it made sense. Dr. Fuselier had the advantage of reading Eric's journal from start to finish. Without the holes, the thrust was obvious. Humans meant nothing. Eric was superior and determined to prove it. Watching us suffer would be enjoyable. Every week he devised colorful new scenarios, crashing planes into buildings, igniting blocks of skyscrapers, ejecting people into outer space. But the objective never wavered. Kill as many as possible, as dramatically as imaginable. In a perfect world, Eric would extinguish the species. Eric was a practical kid, though. The planet was beyond him. Even a block of Denver high-rises was out of reach. But he could pull off a high school. A high school was pragmatic, but the choice was not arbitrary. If jocks had been his target, he would not just have hit the gym. He could have killed a few thousand packing the bleachers at a Columbine football game. If he'd been after the social elites, he could have taken out prom just 3 days before. Eric attacked the symbol of his oppression, the robot factory, and the hub of adolescent existence. For Eric, Columbine was a performance, homicidal art. He actually referred to his audience in his journal. "The majority of the audience won't even understand my motives," he complained. He scripted Columbine as made-for-TV murder, and his chief concern was that we would be too stupid to see the point. Fear was Eric's ultimate weapon. He wanted to maximize the terror. He didn't want kids to fear isolated events, like a sporting event or a dance. He wanted them to fear their daily lives. It worked. Parents across the country were afraid to send their kids to school. Eric didn't have the political agenda of a terrorist, but he had adopted terrorist tactics. Sociology professor Mark Juergensmeyer identified the central characteristic of terrorism as performance violence. Terrorists design events to be spectacular in their viciousness and awesome in their destructive power. Such instances of exaggerated violence are constructed events. They are mind-numbing, mesmerizing theater. The audience, for Timothy McVeigh, Eric Harris, or the Palestine Liberation Organization, was always miles away, watching on TV. Terrorists rarely settle for just shooting. That limits the damage to individuals. They prefer to blow up things, buildings usually, and the smart ones choose carefully. During that brief dramatic moment when a terrorist act levels a building or damages some entity that a society regards as central to its existence, the perpetrators of the act assert that they, and not the secular government, have ultimate control over that entity and its centrality, Juergensmeyer wrote. He pointed out that during the same day as the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, a deadlier attack was leveled against a coffee shop in Cairo. The attacks were presumably coordinated by the same group. The body count was worse in Egypt, yet the explosion was barely reported outside that country. A coffee house is not the World Trade Center, he explained. Most terrorists target symbols of the system they abhor, generally iconic government buildings. Eric followed the same logic. He understood that the cornerstone of his plan was the explosives. When all his bombs fizzled, everything about his attack was misread. He didn't just fail to top Timothy McVeigh's record. He wasn't even recognized for trying. He was never categorized with his peer group. We lumped him in with the pathetic loners who shot people. Eric miscalculated again. It was about drinking this time. He and Dylan talked a friend's mom into buying lots of liquor. She took requests. Eric ordered tequila and Bailey's Irish Cream. Dylan asked for vodka, of course. There was also beer, whiskey, schnapps, and scotch. The group had a little booze fest that weekend. Eric made off with the leftovers and stashed them in the spare tire compartment of his car. He was pretty proud of himself. He had all the booze he needed for a long time. He bought himself a flask and loaded it up with smooth, potent scotch. Eric didn't actually like alcohol, but he loved the idea. He took only 3 sips in the month he owned the flask, but he could sip scotch whenever he wanted. How cool was that? He got a little cocky and bragged to a friend. The jerk routed him out to Eric's dad. There was one hell of a fight at the Harris house that night. Wayne was livid. When are you going to get on track? What are you going to do with your life? Eric spun a fresh batch of lies. He had been keeping up his grades just to maintain his cover story, setting the stage for a fresh round of bullshit. Man, he was good that night. He even quoted lines out of his favorite movies and delivered them like he was totally in the moment. I should have won a freaking Oscar, he wrote in his journal. Despite the fighting, Eric convinced his diversion officer that everything was great with his parents. Kriegshauser noted the happy home life in his notes for every session from that period. Eric had an instinct for when the truth would placate an adult, how much to reveal, and to whom. When he attended anger management class for diversion, he wrote the required response paper, dutifully sucking up about how helpful it was. In person, he sensed Bob Kriegshauser would respond to a different tack. Eric admitted that the class was a waste of time. Bob was proud of him for coming clean. In his session notes, he praised Eric's honesty. Dr. Fuselier found Eric's paper interesting for another reason. Eric really had learned something from the session. He listed the 4 stages of anger and several triggers: quick breathing, tunnel vision, tightened muscles, and clenched teeth. The triggers served as warning signs or symptoms of anger, Eric wrote. Just the kind of information he could use. Eric was a prodigy at masking his true emotions and simulating the desired effect. But prodigy was a long way from pro. Clarifying tiny giveaways where an expert might see through his act, that kind of data was invaluable. Eric described himself as a sponge, and mimicry of agreeable behavior was his number 1 skill. Eric's grades were up, and his teachers were happy. He would end the fall semester with glowing comments on his report card about a positive attitude and cooperation. Dylan was still tanking. On November 3rd, he brought Kriegshauser another progress report. Calculus was no better. And now he had a D in gym, too. It was just tardiness, he explained. You will get there on time, meaning not 1 minute late, Kriegshauser demanded. That better be a passing grade by next session. By their next session, the grade had dropped to an F. Kriegshauser confronted Dylan on the situation, and Dylan tried to weasel out. There was a pattern, Kriegshauser said. Dylan wasn't even trying. The comments from his calculus teacher showed a bad attitude. He wasn't making use of his class time effectively. What was going on there? Dylan said he'd been reading a book in class. Kriegshauser was incredulous. Dylan wasn't much of a smooth talker. Listen to yourself, Kriegshauser told him. Think about what you're saying. You are minimizing everything. You're full of excuses. You sound like you think you're the victim. Kriegshauser said there would be consequences if Dylan's efforts didn't change. That could include termination. Termination would translate to multiple felony convictions. Dylan could find himself in prison. Eric manufactured 3 more pipe bombs, the Charlie batch. Then he halted production until December. What he needed was guns, and that was becoming a problem. Eric had been looking into the Brady Bill. Congress had passed the law restricting the purchase of most popular semi-automatic machine guns in 1993. A federal system of instant background checks would soon go into effect. Eric was going to have a hard time getting around that. "Fuck you, Brady," Eric wrote in his journal. All he wanted was a couple of guns, and thanks to your fucking bill, I will probably not get any. He wanted them only for personal protection, he joked. "It's not like I'm some psycho who would go on a shooting spree, fuckers." Eric frequently made his research do double duty for both schoolwork and his master plan. He wrote up a short research assignment on the Brady Bill that week. It was a good idea, in theory, he said, aside from the loopholes. The biggest problem was that checks applied only to licensed dealers, not private dealers. So 2/3 of the licensed dealers had just gone private. The FBI just shot themselves in the foot, he concluded. Eric was rational about his firepower. "As of this date, I have enough explosives to kill about 100 people," he wrote. With axes, bayonets, and assorted blades, he could maybe take out 10 more. That was as far as hand-to-hand combat would get him. 110 people. That just isn't enough. "Guns," the entry concluded. "I need guns. Give me some fucking firearms." 45. Aftershocks. Milestones were hard. First day of school, first snowfall, first Christmas, first anything. All the ugly memories, all the feelings of helplessness swelled back to the surface. The 6-month anniversary was unnerving. Surveillance video of the killers roaming the cafeteria had just been leaked to CBS. The network led its national news broadcast with the first of footage inside the building during the attack. Eric and Dylan strolled around brandishing their weapons. They picked up abandoned cups from the tables and casually enjoyed a few sips. They shot at the big bombs, and terrified kids scurried away. "It's one thing to hear or read about it, and another thing to see it," Sean Graves' mother said. She cried while she watched. She made herself sit through it. She needed to know. She was coming to terms with inevitability. "I wish it wasn't out," she said, "but I knew that it was going to come out. It was just a matter of time." Her son took a pass. Sean did his homework in the other room. Sean was semi-paralyzed, one of the critically injured kids. Everyone was watching their progress. Anne Marie Hochhalter was struggling. She went to school for physics class, and a tutor taught her the rest at home. Her family had just moved into a new house, outfitted by volunteers to accommodate her wheelchair. Anne Marie was fighting her way toward walking again. A few days before the 6-month anniversary, she finally moved her legs, one at a time, 3 to 4 inches high. "It was a tremendous, tremendous achievement," her dad Ted said, but the pain was still excruciating. The 6-month anniversary jitters made it harder. Rumors were rampant. Eric and Dylan couldn't have done it alone. The TCM is still active. They could strike again at any moment. October 20th, the 6-month mark, seemed like the perfect moment. On October 18th, a fresh rumor surfaced. A friend of Eric and Dylan's who had worked on their school videos told someone he was going to finish the job. The next day, police raided his house, searched the premises, and arrested him. His parents cooperated. He was charged with a felony and held on a $500,000 bond. He was put on suicide watch. He was 17. The kid made a brief appearance in juvenile court on Wednesday, in leg shackles and a green prison uniform. He faced Magistrate John DeVita, the same man who'd sentenced Eric and Dylan 1.5 years earlier. Because the suspect was a minor, his name was withheld and the records sealed. But DeVita confirmed the police had found an incriminating journal. That was the basis for the allegation, he said. A diagram of the school was also recovered, but no signs of activity to carry anything out. In the 12-page diary, the boy lamented his failure to help Eric and Dylan with their troubles. He contemplated suicide. He wrote about it. He talked about it when they came to arrest him. That same day, the sixth-month anniversary, 450 kids called in sick. Why set foot in that deadly school? More drifted out all day. By the closing bell, half the student body was gone. Three of the critically injured kids, Richard Castaldo, Anne-Marie Hochhalter, and Patrick Ireland, stuck it out. Sean Graves stayed home and baked chocolate chip cookies with friends. I didn't want to risk it, he said. Thursday, 14% were still out. The normal absentee rate was 5%. The tension subsided. On Friday, attendance was back near normal. Anne-Marie Hochhalter and her dad went to Leawood Elementary that morning to thank fundraisers and accept donations raised on her behalf. Around 10 a.m., Anne-Marie's mother walked into an Alpha pawn shop south of Denver. She asked to see a handgun. The clerk offered several options. She looked at them through the glass case. She settled on a .38 caliber revolver. That one. While he got started on the background check, she turned her back to the counter and loaded. She had brought the ammo with her. First, she fired at the wall. The second shot entered through her right temple. Paramedics rushed Carla June to Swedish Medical Center, the same hospital that had treated Anne-Marie. Carla June died a few minutes later. A counselor who had worked with the family came by the house to notify the family. Anne-Marie answered the door, and the counselor asked to talk to Ted. I started to breathe really fast, Anne-Marie said later. I just had an ominous feeling. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, the counselor said. Carla's dead. Ted Hochhalter crumpled. No, Anne-Marie said. No, no, no. Her dad pulled up and hugged her. It took him a few minutes to compose himself, and the counselor explained how it had happened. We just broke down again, Anne-Marie said. The look on my dad's face will be etched in my memory forever. It was just a look of sorrow and horror. Columbine's mental health hotline was flooded with calls on Saturday. Several distraught messages were queued up on the machine when counselors arrived. They added an extra weekend shift. It's been a hard week, a Jeffco official said. They're sad and depressed and they want to talk. Parents had watched their kids sputtering on the brink for months, especially this month. Other parents had no idea what their kids were thinking. Were they getting that desperate too? Would Carla's choice seem like a way out? Some kids fought the same thoughts about their parents. I just can't take it, Steve Cohn told the Associated Press. I can't believe someone killed themselves over those idiots. Steve's boy, Aaron, had made it out of the library unscathed physically, but the stress was wrenching the family apart. I drive by the school, and I'm looking behind every tree, Steve said. I feel like a cop. I want to prevent it before it happens again. Steve and his son had both gone to counseling, but that was useless while Aaron was shut down. Until he opens up, there's nothing we can do, his dad said. Connie Mihalik was especially rattled. She'd spent months beside Carla at Swedish Medical Center, watching their children recover. Connie was Richard Castaldo's mom. Neither child was expected to walk again. This just destroyed her, Connie said. You'd look in her eyes and see she was lost. It didn't seem like she was there anymore. She was sweet and loving and kind, but it was too much for her. Connie had felt herself waver, too. When it first happened, Carla was just like any other parent, she said. We were all depressed and devastated. There was a time when I thought I had nothing to live for. She was no different from us. Connie worked past it. Carla could not. We kind of saw her slipping, Connie said. I saw her slide downhill. But Connie never foresaw that deep a plunge. She assumed Carla would pull out of it, especially when Anne-Marie moved her legs. What most people in the community did not know was that Carla was at the end of a long struggle with mental illness. The Hochhalter family wanted the public to understand that. After her death, they released a statement saying she had been battling clinical depression for 3 years. She had been suicidal in the past. She had been on medication. A month earlier, Ted had called the authorities at 3 a.m. to report her missing. She walked into a local emergency room the next day, seeking treatment for depression. She was hospitalized for a month. 8 days before her suicide, she was transferred to an outpatient program. The family later revealed that Carla had been diagnosed as bipolar. Columbine aggravated Carla's depression horribly. She may or may not have gone over the edge without it, but the Columbine tragedy was not the underlying cause. The school suspended the boy who'd made the anniversary threat, pending expulsion. That made 8 expulsion proceedings in Jeffco since April, for a variety of gun threats and bomb scares. Everything was zero tolerance now. No one was taking chances. The boy spent 7 weeks in jail through Thanksgiving. It was during this period that the community learned of his plan. He'd intended to fill his car with gasoline canisters and plow into the school as a suicide bomber. In December, he pleaded down to 2 minor charges and was sentenced to a 1-year juvenile diversion program, just as Eric and Dylan had been. Other charges were dropped, including theft. He had stolen $100 from the video store he worked at to run away to Texas. He had begun seeing a psychiatrist and taking medication. The sentence required both to continue. "This is a troubled young man, and he will be getting the help he needs," the prosecutor said. The half-year anniversary also brought a deadline. Colorado law requires that anyone who wants to sue a government agency for negligence must file an intent notice within 180 days. 20 families filed. Notices came from families of the dead, families of the injured, and the Klebolds. Tom and Sue Klebold charged Stone's department with reckless, willful, and wanton misconduct for failing to alert them about its 1998 investigation into Eric's behavior, particularly his death threats. That warning would, more likely than not, have caused the Klebolds to become aware of dangers of which they were not aware and demand that their son Dylan be excluded from all contacts with Eric Harris, the filing read. The failure caused the Klebolds to be subject to substantial damage claims, vilification, grief, and loss of enjoyment of life. The notice said the family expected to be sued by victims and sought damages from Jeffco equal to those eventual settlements. The Klebolds had cause for concern. The two families still topped most blame lists. The filing took the community by surprise. No one had heard from the Harrises or Klebolds in months. The harshest rebuke came from Sheriff Stone. "I think it's outrageous," he said. "It's their parenting thing, not our fault for their kid doing this thing." He also lamented the tragedy degenerating to an ugly stage. Brian Rohrbaugh took the Klebolds' move in stride. "It surprised him at first," he said, "but on reflection, it seems reasonable." He directed his outrage at Sheriff Stone's response. "We felt that it was really ugly April 20th, Brian said. Wayne and Kathy finally agreed to meet with investigators without immunity, October 25th. It was a brief session led by Sheriff Stone. There is no record of it being documented in a police report. Only 2 people would be charged with a crime: Mark Maines, who'd sold the Tech 9, and Phil Duran, who'd brokered the deal. Months earlier, Agent Fuselier had predicted that the two would be savaged, with both legitimate and displaced anger. "Those 2 guys stepped in front of a freight train," he said. He was right. Maines was up first. He copped to a plea agreement and was sentenced on November 11th. It was ugly. 9 families spoke at the hearing. Every one of them demanded the maximum. "I ask you clearly to make a statement," Tom Mauser, one of the 13, implored. If we had our way, the defendant would never be allowed on the streets again, the Scholes family said. The testimony lasted for 2 hours. Maines hung his head. Videos made by two families hit especially hard. The court reporter passed boxes of Kleenex around the gallery. Maines's lawyer described a rough childhood. His client had gotten in trouble, then mended his ways. Maines had gotten off drugs, gone to college, and obtained a steady job in the computer field. His character today is exemplary, he said. That infuriated the relatives. Having that attorney talk about how wonderful Mark Maines is, that was tough, Dave Sanders' daughter Connie said. He wasn't misunderstood, he was in the wrong. Maines spoke last. He faced the judge and assured him that he'd had no idea what Eric and Dylan were planning. I was horrified, he said. I told my parents I never want to see a gun for the rest of my life. There is no way I can adequately explain my sorrow to the families. It is something I will regret for the rest of my life. Maines was eligible for 18 years in prison, but his plea agreement knocked that down to a maximum of 9. Judge Henry Nieto said he had no choice. The conduct of this defendant was the first step in what became an earthquake. All of us have a moral duty when we see the potential for harm to intervene. 9 years, but he would assign them concurrently, so Maines would serve only 6, with parole maybe as little as 3. Nieto warned the families not to expect comfort from the sentence. Maines looked calm, but he took it hard. His lawyer put his hand on Maines's neck and whispered that he loved him. Maines was led away in handcuffs. The families applauded. Maines' lawyer described his client as a scapegoat. There's no one else to be angry at, he told NBC. These people have all this understandable anger. It has to go somewhere. Christian martyr Cassie Bernal offered hope. In September, Misty went on a national book tour. She Said Yes, leapt onto the New York Times bestseller list in its first week. The Rocky Mountain News editors had a dilemma. They knew Cassie had never said yes. They had expected to shatter the myth by now, but they were still waiting for the sheriff's report. They had to cover the book's release. The editors decided to run 2 pieces on publication day, affirming Cassie's myth. A few weeks later, another publication broke the news. The Rocky followed up with Emily Wyant's testimony. With the story out, Emily agreed to allow her name to be used. The Bernal's publisher lashed out at Emily. The news made front pages as far away as London. Brad and Misty were caught by surprise. They felt humiliated and betrayed by Emily, by the cops, and by the secular press. The evidence against martyrdom was overwhelming, but Cassie's youth pastor saw stronger forces at play. You will never change the story of Cassie, Reverend Dave McPherson said. The church is going to stick to the martyr story. You can say it didn't happen that way, but the church won't accept it. He didn't mean just his church. He meant the vast evangelical community worldwide. And to a large extent, he was right. Book sales continued briskly. A vast array of websites sprang up to defend the story. Others just repeated it without even mentioning that it had been debunked. Jeffco also faced a series of embarrassing leaks. Investigators had let the video get loose to CBS and had revealed the truth about Cassie Bernal. Lead investigator Kate Batten had broken her silence and spoken to one reporter, and the first passages from Eric's journal had slipped out. And yet, the department maintained its official silence. It delayed the report again. The victims' families were furious. The sheriff's department's credibility plummeted. Its officers had done a thorough job of detective work on the case, but the public had no way to see that. Jeffco expressed shock and bewilderment at the leaks. Officials offered flimsy excuses and assurances. A spokesman insisted that only 2 copies of Eric's journal existed, when in fact it had been run through photocopiers repeatedly, and no one had a clue how many copies were floating around. Then the undersheriff let a Time reporter watch the basement tapes. He had assured the families repeatedly they would be the first to see the videos. The magazine ran an expose cover story shortly before Christmas. Stone and Undersheriff John Dunaway posed in their dress blues with white gloves, armed with the killer's semi-automatics. Many families were aghast. Several called for Stone to resign. Charges of cowardice against the SWAT teams resurfaced. Prominent law enforcement officials joined the chaos. Stone insisted that his department would be exonerated by the final report, which was delayed again. Turbulence was expected that fall. Everyone knew they would face anniversaries and hearings. No one foresaw the string of aftershocks. The school was sued over a craft project gone awry. The Rohrbaughs charged infringement of their religious expression. Brian Rohrbaugh repeated the crosses incident at a memorial garden created at Cassie's church. His group picketed Sunday services and then chopped down two of the 15 trees in front of the horrified youth group that had planted them. They inadvertently chose the tree symbolizing Cassie. Bomb threats were a regular occurrence, but one gained traction in the wake of the Time story. The school was shut down until after Christmas. Finals were canceled. Legal battles over the basement tapes began. "When will it end?" a local pastor asked. "Why us? What is happening in our community?" The new year began, and it got worse. A young boy was found dead in a dumpster a few blocks from Columbine High. On Valentine's Day, two students were shot dead in a subway shop two blocks from the school. The star of the basketball team committed suicide. 2 weeks ago, they found the kid in the dumpster, a friend of the subway victims told reporters. "Now, I kind of want to move. This is worse than Columbine." Students had grudgingly come to adopt their school's name as the title of a tragedy. Some events were unrelated to the massacre or even the school, but much of the community had lost the ability to distinguish. Perspective was impossible. A fight with your girlfriend, a car crash, a drought. It was all Columbine. It was a curse. Kids were calling it the Columbine curse. Appointments at the mental health facility set up for Columbine survivors rose sharply through the fall. "Many come in after they've tried everything they know how to do," a psychologist on the team said. Utilization peaked about 9 months after the tragedy and held steady until a year and a half out. At any given time during that period, case managers were following about 15 kids on suicide watch. Gradually, each one came down from the brink, but another took that kid's place. Substance abuse spiked. The area experienced a marked increase in traffic accidents and DUIs. By definition, PTSD is a triad of change for the worse, lasting at least a month, occurring any time after a genuine trauma, wrote PTSD pioneer Dr. Frank Ochberg. The triad of disabling responses is 1, recurring intrusive recollections, 2, emotional numbing and a constriction of life activity, and 3, a physiological shift in the fear threshold, affecting sleep, concentration, and sense of security. Response to PTSD varies dramatically. Some people feel too much, others too little. The overfeelers often suffer flashbacks. Nothing can drive away the terror. They awake each morning knowing it may be April 20th all over again. They can go hours, weeks, or months without an episode, and then a trigger, often a sight, sound, or smell, will take them right back. It's not a bad memory of the event. It feels like it is the event. Others protect themselves by shutting down altogether. Pleasant feelings and joy get eliminated with the bad. They often describe feeling numb. It was a rough year. The football team offered a respite. Matthew Kechter had been a sophomore when he was killed in the library. He had played JV on the defensive line in the 1998 season and had hoped to make varsity this fall. At his parents' request, the team dedicated the season to Matt. Each player wore Matt's number on his helmet and Matt's initials, MJK, on his cap. They finished the season 12-1. They came from 17 behind in the fourth quarter to win the first playoff game. The players wept on the field. They chanted, MJK, MJK. They were heavy underdogs for the state championship. Denver powerhouse Cherry Creek High had taken 5 of the last 10 titles. Columbine had made it to the big game only once, a loss 2 decades back. Supporters flew in from around the world. 8,000 people packed the stadium. The media were everywhere. The New York Times covered the game. The temperature dropped below freezing. Patrick Ireland sat in the front row, trying to keep warm. Cherry Creek went ahead early. Columbine tied it up at the half, and then their defense came on strong. They allowed just 2 first downs in the second half, and a 3rd touchdown put it away. Columbine won, 21-14. Fans rushed the field. The familiar chant thundered through the stands. We are Columbine! We are Columbine! The school held a victory rally. A highlight reel of the game was projected, ending with a picture of Matt. This one's for you, it said. A moment of silence was held for all 13. Some kids seemed immune to the gloom. Others fought private battles on completely different chronologies. Patrick Ireland made steady improvements, keeping his 4.0 average that fall, and made sure valedictorian was still in sight. But a more significant problem loomed. Patrick had had his life pretty well figured out junior year. Before he got shot, he was going to be an architect. His grandfather had been a builder, and Patrick had taken to drawing in his junior high drafting class. He lined up that T-square against the drafting table, and he could feel it. He liked the precision. He enjoyed the artistry. At Columbine, he worked with sophisticated computer-aided design software. While Eric and Dylan finalized their plot, Patrick was deep into research on college programs and had started investigating internships. He was still going to be an architect. Patrick clung to the dream straight through outpatient therapy. He took breaks for 3 out-of-state campus visits at schools with leading architecture programs. They all accepted him. But they stressed how rigorous the work would be. Architecture programs are known for their massive workloads, 5 years of relentless all-nighters. All-night was not an option for Patrick. He could cheat himself out of a couple hours sleep, but his brain would take years to recover. He would slow his progress by taxing it too hard, and possibly even bring on seizures. In March, he took a school trip to England. The jet lag was tough. Kathy went with him, and Friday night she noticed his face went blank and his eyeball fluttered for a few seconds. "Did you do that on purpose?" she asked. "Do what?" Kathy believes it was a precursor to the event 2 days later. Patrick was walking through London and collapsed in the middle of a street. He shook violently, made it almost to the curb, and called out to a friend for help. A London doctor prescribed anti-seizure medication. The family confirmed the treatment back home, and Patrick will be on it for life. Architecture school wasn't going to work. John and Kathy understood that from the start, but they waited for Patrick to accept the situation. He opted for Colorado State, just over an hour away. He would try business school for a year. CSU had an architecture program, too. If, a year later, he felt he could handle it, he could transfer. Despite the cloud over his future, Patrick regained his bearing through the year. Socially, he was having the time of his life. Patrick had always been a catch. He'd been bright, charming, handsome, and athletic. He had been a little short on confidence from time to time. Laura would have given anything to go to the prom with Patrick. She might have become his girlfriend if he had asked. The shotgun blasts had robbed him of some of his best assets, but he was a star. He was the most celebrated figure to live through the tragedy, and he had put up an incredible fight. Girls flirted unabashedly. But Patrick wanted Laura. That first summer, he told her how much he wanted her, how deeply and how long. "God, me too," she said. What a relief. Finally, after all this time, it was out in the open. Laura confessed everything, all those nights flirting on the phone, hinting her heart out for him to ask. If only he had asked her to the prom. "Okay," Patrick said. "I like you, you like me. Let's do something about it." Too late. She was dating the prom dude. That didn't seem like an obstacle. "Do you want to be with me?" "Yes." "Then break up with him." She said she would do it. He gave her time. He asked again, "When are you going to do it?" She said it would be soon, but nothing happened. Girls were fighting for the chance to date him, so he got tired of waiting and asked one out. Then he asked another one and another. This was fun. Things grew strained with Laura. They never went out. They began avoiding each other. It was fourth grade all over again. 46. Guns. Eric named his shotgun Arlene. He acquired her on November 22, 1998, and declared it an important date in the history of Reb. "We have guns," he wrote. "We fucking got them, you sons of bitches. Ha!" Eric and Dylan had driven into Denver for the Tanner Gun Show the day before. They'd found some sweet-ass weapons, a 9mm carbine rifle and a pair of 12-gauge shotguns, one double-barreled and one pump-action single. They tried to buy them, and that was a great big no-go. Eric's charm was not getting them over this hurdle. No ID, no guns. They drove back to the suburbs. Eric would be 18 shortly before their attack date in April. They could have just waited, but Eric wanted real firepower to keep the plan on track. There was one more day in the gun show. Who did they know who was 18? Plenty of people. Who would do it for them? Who could they trust? Robin. Sweet little church girl Robin. She was nuts about Dylan. She would do anything for him. Wouldn't she? The following day, it was done. In his journal, Eric labeled this the point of no return. Then he waxed nostalgic about his dad. "He'd had a lot of fun at the gun show," he wrote. "I would have loved it if you were there, Dad. We would have done some major bonding. It would have been great. Oh, wait. But, alas, I fucked up and told my friend about the flask." That had been the end of good relations with Wayne for a while. Now his parents were on his ass more than ever about his future. "What do you want to do with your life?" That was easy. NBK. "This is what I am motivated for," he wrote. "This is my goal. This is what I want to do with my life." Eric and Dylan sawed the barrels off their new shotguns, cut them way below the legal limit. The first week in December, they took the rifle out and fired it. A bullet erupted in the chamber, and the butt slammed into Eric's bony shoulder. Wow! That thing packed a lot of power. This wasn't a pipe bomb in his hands. This could kill somebody. Psychopaths generally turn to murder only when their callousness combines with a powerful sadistic streak. Psychologist Theodore Millen identified 10 basic subtypes of the psychopath. Only two are characterized by brutality or murder: the malevolent psychopath and the tyrannical. In these rare subtypes, the psychopath is driven less by a greed for material gain than by desire for his own aggrandizement and the brutal punishment of inferiors. Eric fit both categories. His sadistic streak permeated the journal, but a late autumn entry suggests the life Eric might have led had Columbine not ended it. He described tricking girls to come to his room, raping them, and then proceeding to the real fun. "I want to tear a throat out with my own teeth, like a pop can," he wrote. "I want to grab some weak little freshman and just tear them apart like a fucking wolf, strangle them, squish their head, rip off their jaw, break their arms in half, show them who is God." Eric had not given up on the 23-year-old. For months he kept calling Brenda. She told him she had a new boyfriend, but he persisted. Late in the year, she met him at a macaroni grill. He was really bummed out, she said. She thought he was bummed because she'd dumped him. He denied it, but offered no explanation. She never saw him again. Just before Christmas, Eric celebrated his last final, ever, He laughed at his classmates, who assumed they had another batch ahead. The next day, Eric ordered several 10-round magazines for his carbine rifle. Those would do some damage. He could peel off 130 rounds in rapid succession. There was a problem. Eric gave Green Mountain Guns his home number. They called just before New Year's, and his dad answered. "Your clips are in," the clerk told him. "Clips?" He didn't order any gun clips. Eric overheard the conversation. Oh, God. He described the incident in his journal. Jesus Christ, that was fucking close. Fucking shitheads at the gun shop almost dropped the whole project. Luckily, Wayne never stopped to ask the guy if he had the right number, and the guy never asked any questions either. That could have been the end of it right there. If either one of them had handled that phone call a little differently, the entire plan might have come crashing down, Eric said. But they didn't. But Wayne was suspicious. "Thank God I can BS so fucking well," Eric wrote. Once they got the guns, Eric lost interest in the Book of God. It was on to implementation. After New Year's, he would leave just one final installment, a few weeks before they did the deed. Eric was raring to go. Dylan continued to waver. Existences had been silent for 5 months since he said goodbye. But on January 20th, Bob Kriegshauser called Dylan in for an important meeting. Dylan resumed his journal the same day. "This shit again," he began. He didn't want to be writing this again. He wanted to be free, meaning dead. "I thought it would have been time by now," he wrote. "The pain multiplies infinitely, never stops." Eric's plan offered the solace of suicide. "Maybe going NBK, God, with Eric is the best way to be free. I hate this." Then more hearts and love. He hardly seemed committed to the plan, but he appeared to be putting up a good front to Eric. Neither boy ever recorded a suggestion of Dylan's resistance, but Eric seemed to be doing most of the work. Eric was also working hard to get laid. He made a final stab with Brenda, leaving a string of messages on her answering machine. "I'm sorry I lied to you," he said. "There's something we need to talk about. I'm 17. He was through lying, he said. He wanted to take their relationship to the next level, and she could keep the Rammstein CD he'd left at her house. He wouldn't be needing them anymore. The last part made her nervous. She called back to make sure he was all right, and she reiterated one more time that they were just friends. Eric wasn't bothered. He was working another chick. Christy was the girl he had passed notes with in German class. Lately, she seemed interested in war, so she tried a sort of informal group date to rock and bowl night at Bellevue Lanes. Christy liked him, but she was conflicted. There was this other guy, a friend of Eric's, Nate Dykeman. Bastard. Eric turned on the charm, and Christy went for it, just not enough. It was sex he really wanted. He had no interest in a real relationship, and maybe Christy picked up on that. Nate moved in on Christy fast. They started dating, got serious, and Eric turned on Nate. As Eric wrapped up plans for April 20th, Dylan was laying into his journal in a frenzy. They were short entries and erratic, tossing aside all his conventions. Several ran half a page or less. He was expressing himself more and more in pictures, all his old icons returning, linked together in wild, feverish strokes. Fluttering hearts were everywhere, filling up entire pages, blasting out the road to happiness, bursting with stars and powered by an engine shaped like the symbol for infinity. Dylan was focused on one topic now, love. Up until his final week, Dylan wrote privately of almost nothing else.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 10. Columbine, by Dave Cullen. Continued. Disc 10.
47. Lawsuits. 10 days before the first anniversary, Brian Rohrbaugh threw a Hail Mary. The cops had been stonewalling, and litigation looked like the only answer. Families could sue for negligence or wrongful death and use the process to force out information. the verdict would be less important than discovery. Should they sue? How could they know? It all rested on Jeffco's final report. If Jeffco released all the evidence, most families would be satisfied. If Jeffco held back, they were going to court. No one had anticipated that the report would take this long. Way back in the summer of 1999, Jeffco had said its report was 6 to 8 weeks away. It was April now, and the officials were still saying they had 6 to 8 weeks to go. The investigators had wrapped up most of their work in the first 4 months, but Jeffco was skittish about presenting the information. Yet the longer they waited, the more leaks they risked, the more rebukes, and the higher the stakes to get every sentence right. Even the school administration was frustrated. "We keep getting ready," Mr. D told the magazine in April. "I keep telling the community, okay, we're about 2 weeks away. We're 2 weeks away." There's only so many times you can get so wound up saying, "Oh, I'm ready now, I'm ready," and then all of a sudden, no. There's a level of frustration. The delays were maddening, but a practical problem was also arising. The first anniversary coincided with the statute of limitations. By delaying the report past April 20th, 2000, Jeffco forced the families to trust them or sue. That was an easy choice. On April 10th, the Rohrbachs and the Flemings filed an open records request demanding to see the report immediately, one last option to avoid a lawsuit. Since they were filing, they asked for everything, including the basement tapes, the killer's journals, the 911 calls, and surveillance videos. Rohrbach wanted to compare the raw data to the narrative under construction by Jeffco. He predicted a chasm. "They lie as a practice," he said. District Judge R. Brooke Jackson read the request. He said yes. Over furious objections from Jeffco, 3 days before the anniversary, he allowed the plaintiffs to read the draft report. He also granted them access to hundreds of hours of 911 tapes and some video footage. He agreed to begin reading the 200 binders of evidence himself, but noted that would take months. The ruling stunned everyone, but it was too little, too late. 15 families filed suits against the sheriff's department that week. They would add additional defendants later. The Klebolds chose not to sue. Instead, they issued another apology letter. The Harrises did the same. The lawsuits were expected to fail. The legal thresholds were too high. In federal court, negligence was insufficient. Families needed to prove officers had actually made the students worse off. And that was only the first hurdle, but the main strategy was to flush out information. The one suit with a plausible chance came from Dave Sanders' daughter, Angela. She was represented by Peter Grenier, a powerhouse Washington, D.C. lawyer. They charged that Jeffco officials went beyond neglecting Dave Sanders for 3 hours. They impeded his movement and prohibited others from getting him out of there. They deceived volunteer rescuers with false claims about an imminent arrival to discourage them from busting out a window or taking him down the stairs. By doing so, the suit argued, Jeffco accepted responsibility for Dave and then let him die. In legal terms, they denied his civil rights by cutting off all opportunities to save him when they were not prepared to do it themselves. The Rohrbachs and others followed similar logic. The library kids could have escaped easily, they said, unencumbered by police help. It looked ugly, but legal analysts were skeptical about any case holding up. It's going to be tough to ask a jury to say we know better than a SWAT team how to handle this situation, said Sam Kamen, law professor at the University of Denver. In legal circles, the lawsuits had been expected, but their ferocity shook the community. The anniversary was overwhelmed by animosity again, and media were everywhere. Many of the 13 left town. The school closed for the day and conducted a private memorial. A public service was held in Clement Park. A few days after the anniversary, Judge Jackson ordered the Sheriff's Department to release its report to the public by May 15th. He also released more evidence, including a video that drew a lot of heat. For months, Jeffco had referred to it as a training video created by the Littleton Fire Department. It was based on footage shot in the library shortly after the bodies were removed. It would be the family's first look at the gruesome scene. It would be difficult to watch, Jackson's ruling stated, but that was no reason to suppress it. There is no compelling public interest consideration that requires that the video or any part of it not be disclosed under the Open Records Act, Jackson wrote. The next day, Jeffco began duplicating the tape and selling copies for $25. Spokesman said the fee was to defray copying costs. The families were aghast. Then they saw the tape. There was no instruction, no narration, no attempt at training. It was someone's ghastly attempt at commemoration, grisly crime scene footage set to pop music, Sarah McLachlan's I Will Remember You. McLachlan's record company threatened to sue for copyright infringement. Jeffco removed the music. Sales remained strong. Brian Rohrbaugh had broken through Jeffco's armor. Judge Jackson kept ordering releases. In May, he unleashed all the 911 tapes and a ballistics report. For a while, everything he read, he released. The killer's families tried to stop him. On May 1st, they filed a joint motion to keep materials seized from their homes private. That would include the most vital evidence, the journals and the basement tapes. Jeffco released its report on May 15th, as ordered. The focus of the package was a minute-by-minute timeline of April 20, 1999, in great detail. It dramatically illustrated how fast everything happened. Just 7.5 minutes in the library, all the deaths and injuries in the first 16 minutes. How convenient, critics said. The cops' report was dedicated to illustrating that the cops had never had a chance. As expected, the report ducked the central question of why. Instead, it provided about 700 pages of what, how, and when. The logistics were useful, but they were hardly what people had been waiting for. There were three paragraphs about advance warning by the Browns, one paragraph summarizing and two defending. The department claimed it had been unable to access Eric's website, despite the fact that officials had printed the pages, filed them, and retrieved them within minutes of the attack on April 20th, and had cited them at length in the search warrants issued before the bodies were found. But a year after the murders, Jeffco was still suppressing the file and the search warrants, so the family suspected a lie, but they couldn't prove it. Jeffco was ridiculed for its report. Officials seemed truly bewildered by the response. Privately, they insisted they were just acting the way they always did, building a case internally, keeping their conclusions to themselves. Communicating the results was the prosecutor's role. It wasn't their job. They still couldn't grasp that this was not any normal case. As the battles intensified, compassion fatigue set in. Hardly anyone said it out loud. Chuck Green, a Denver Post columnist and one of Denver's nastier personalities, broke the ice. He stunned the families with a pair of columns, charging them with milking the tragedy. They had gotten millions, he wrote. It had been an avalanche of anguish never before witnessed, yet the Columbine victims still have their hands out for more. The parents' group was caught unaware. They'd had no idea. They were more stunned by the support for Green's ideas. All of us are sick and tired of the continued whining, a reader responded. Another said those sentiments had been circulating for quite a while, whispering in small circles amongst clouds of guilt. It was out in the open now. The anniversary also offered a window of political opportunity. Tom Mauser had been energized at the NRA protest and devoted himself to the cause. I am not a natural leader, but speaking out helps me because it carries on Daniel's life, he said. Tom took a one-year leave of absence to serve as chief lobbyist for SAFE, Colorado, Sane Alternatives to the Firearms Epidemic. They supported several bills in the Colorado legislature to limit access to guns for minors and criminals. Prospects looked good, especially for the flagship proposal to close the gun show loophole. It was narrowly defeated in February. A similar measure bogged down in Congress. So a week before the anniversary, President Clinton returned to Denver to encourage survivors and support SAFE's new strategy to pass the same measure in Colorado with a ballot initiative. Colorado Republican leaders rebuked the president and refused to appear with him. Republican Governor Bill Owens supported the ballot initiative but refused to attend an MSNBC town hall meeting hosted by Tom Brokaw until President Clinton left the stage midway through the show. The visit appeared to force a little movement in Washington. Just before the meeting with Brokaw, House leaders announced a bipartisan compromise on gun show legislation. But it had been a year already, and there was still a long way to go. Tom Mauser kept fighting. At a rally the same week, SAFE spread 4,223 pairs of shoes across the state capitol steps, one for each minor killed by a gun in 1997. Tom took the sneakers off his feet and held them up to the crowd. They had been Daniel's. Tom took to wearing them to rallies. He needed a tangible link to his son, and they helped the shy man connect Daniel to his audience. On May 2nd, the governor and attorney general, the state's most prominent Republican and Democrat, put the first two signatures on the petition for the Colorado ballot initiative. It required 62,438 signatures. They gathered nearly twice that many. The measure would pass by a 2-to-1 margin. The gun show loophole was closed in Colorado. It was defeated in Congress. No significant national gun control legislation was enacted in response to Columbine. The season ended well. On May 20th, the second class of survivors graduated. 9 of the injured crossed the stage, 2 in wheelchairs. Patrick Ireland limped to the podium to give the valedictory address. "It had been a tough year," he said. "The shooting made the country aware of the unexpected level of hate and rage that had been hidden in high schools. But he was convinced the world was inherently good at heart. He had spent the year thinking about what had gotten him across the library floor. At first he assumed hope. Not quite. It was trust. When I fell out the window, I knew somebody would catch me," he said. "That's what I need to tell you, that I knew the loving world was there all the time." Part 5. Judgment Day. 48. An Emotion of God. Eric had work to do. Napalm was hard. It's an inherently unstable substance. Eric found lots of recipes online, but they never seemed to produce what the instructions predicted. The first batch was awful. He tried again, just as bad. He kept varying the ingredients and the heating process, but it was one failure after another. Multiple batches were no easy feat either. Eric didn't specify how or when he conducted his experiments. Presumably, he carried them out in the same place he did everything else, his house, when his parents were out. Each batch was a chore, time-consuming, and risky. It involved mixing gasoline with other substances and then heating it on the stove, trying to make it congeal into a slushy syrup that would ignite with just a spark, but burn continuously for some time when shot with force through a projectile tube. Eric had to construct the flamethrowers, too. He drew out detailed sketches of his weaponry in the back of his journal notebook. Some were quite practical, others pure fantasy. Dylan seemed to be no help with any of it. Each killer left hundreds of pages of writings and drawings and schedules in their day planners, and Eric's are riddled with plans, logs, and results of experiments. Dylan shows virtually no effort. Eric acquired the guns, the ammo, and apparently the material for the bombs, and did the planning and construction. Figuring out how to sneak the huge bombs into the crowded cafeteria was another big problem. each contraption would bulge out of a 3-foot duffel bag and weigh about 50 pounds. They couldn't just trot them into the middle of the lunchroom, plop them down in front of 600 people, and walk out without notice. Or could they? At some point, the boys gave up scheming. They decided to just walk right in with the bombs. It was a bold move, but textbook psychopath. Perpetrators of complex attacks tend to focus on weak links and minimize risk. Psychopaths are reckless. They have supreme confidence in their work. Eric planned meticulously for a year, only to open with a blunder that neutralized 95% of the attack. He showed no hint that he had even considered the gaping flaw. Now he had to concentrate on getting Dylan a second gun, and Eric had a whole lot of production work. If only he had a little more cash, he could move the experiments along. Oh, well, you could fund only so many bombs at a pizza factory, and he needed his brakes checked, and he just had to buy winter wiper blades, and he had a whole bunch of new CDs to pick up. They also had diversion to put behind them. Eric was a star in the program. His sterling performance earned him a rare early release, something only 5% of kids achieve. Kriegshauser decided to let Dylan out with him, despite Dylan's failure to raise his D in calculus. Kriegshauser advised Dylan to be careful about his future choices. His exit report said Dylan struggled with motivation in school, but the summary was all rosy. Prognosis? Good. Dylan is a bright young man who has a great deal of potential. If he is able to tap his potential and become self-motivated, he should do well in life. Recommendations? Successful termination. Dylan has earned the right for an early termination. He needs to strive to self-motivate himself so he can remain on a positive path. He is intelligent enough to make any dream a reality, but he needs to understand hard work is part of it. Dylan responded with a bleak existences entry. This was the meeting that drove him back to the journal. He wrote the same day, but failed to mention the good news. He insisted life was getting worse. In one sense, it was. Release from diversion was a painful sign. Dylan had not planned on leaving the program alive. Eric earned a glowing report start to finish. Prognosis? Good. Eric is a very bright young man who is likely to succeed in life. He is intelligent enough to achieve lofty goals as long as he stays on task and remains motivated. Recommendations: successful termination. Eric should seek out more education at higher levels. He impressed me as being very articulate and intelligent. These are skills that he should grow and use as frequently as possible. Both boys arrived at murder gradually, but one event pushed each of them over the hump. Eric's occurred January 30, 1998, when Deputy Walsh shackled his wrists. From that night on, the boy was set on murder. Dylan's turn came a full year later and was more gradual, but the turning point seems clear. It was February 1999. They had agreed on April a year in advance, and it was almost here. Eric was serious. He was really going through with it. Dylan was conflicted, as always, still leaning against, heavily against. Dylan wanted to be a good boy. He had three choices: give in, back out, or perform a hasty suicide. Those three choices had been hanging there for a year or more. He could not decide. Then Dylan wrote a short story. It revolved around an angry man in black, methodically gunning down a dozen preps. The man did it for vengeance and amusement, and to demonstrate he could. Dylan lifted most of the details right out of the NBK plan. He armed and outfitted his killer the way they planned to dress themselves. The story included a duffel bag, the diversion bombs, and reconnoitering the victim's habits. The smallest details match. The killer is a blend. His height matches Dylan's, but he behaves exactly like Eric, callous and methodical, viciously angry, yet detached.